there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Dear listeners, we have an exciting announcement. As our longtime listeners may recall, back in March on episode 9, we interviewed Bradbury and sci-fi scholar Phil Nichols to prepare us for Bradbury's Zen and the Art of Writing. Now, along with running bradburymedia.co.uk, Nichols has not just one, but two podcasts. Bradbury 100, celebrating the centenary of Ray Bradbury, and Sci-Fi 100, where he discusses different sci-fi topics, books, media, movies. Essentially, he's just a big nerd. But we're big nerds too. So guess what? We are on his podcast. So he did a really cool interview with us. Now that we're done with Bradbury's Zen and the Art of Writing, and you can listen to our interview on his most recent episode, episode 38. So thanks, Phil. It was fun. And now onto our podcast.
It's a different way of thinking about it. Usually you think a sequel as from, say, one book to another book, a series of novels, you know, like Fire and Ice. But he uses it as a way to link scenes.
I think your co-host said something about the meat being the scenes, and I see the sequels as being the sinew that ties them together.
If you listen to our last episode, you know all about Bickham's sequel. But do published writers and professional editors subscribe to this Bickham structure? We decided to find out.
This is a fascinating concept for me because I'm a real gut editor. I know if something works, I know when something doesn't work, but I don't have an MFA, I don't have an English degree, even I have history degrees. So a lot of times I don't have the terminology. It's only stuff like this where I'm reading about it and then I say, oh, that's describing what I felt when I read XYZ. I'm Zoe Quinton and I run a developmental editing business. I'm at www.zoequinton.com.
When you're doing editing, even if you're working from your gut, do you actively look for a reflection or an internalization after an external scene?
Yes, I would look for that. What stands out to me more is if that internalization comes in the middle of the scene. I'm thinking of a recent client where he had a third-person narrator, and a third-person narrator would come in and drop a line in the middle of an action scene about themselves or their insights. And I found it very jarring. So I think for me, more important than that scene, sequel sequence is to make sure that your scenes are set pieces and that they're action and they build. And then if you are going to have some kind of introspection or integration of what the characters learn or formulation of new plans, that has to come in between scenes.
And in his description, he has a progression. He has an emotional reaction. He has a more analytical thinking. And then he has the character coming up with a new plan or a new way forward and a set of action. Do you find that kind of arc works really well for your clients' novels? Or do you find that it's just kind of a loose framework?
I would prefer to see it as a loose framework. If adhered to strictly, it would start to feel formulaic. I'm a very organic editor, so I would prefer to feel a little bit more organic flow between those things instead of checking each box every time you have the end of a scene. But I do think it's essential to have maybe one or two of those things that he talks about. Maybe at the end of one scene, the main character makes a decision for the next time, but it's not this big introspective feelings moment. You know, and then maybe another scene happens or two scenes back to back, and then they have a big feelings moment, either internally or they could process it with another character. My fear is that it would get too wooden if you did those every single time.
And then there are authors whose books work outside the Bickham scene-sequel-scene structure.
Yeah, I'm Terry Tierney, and my recently published novel is Lucky Ride, which came out in December from Unsolicited Press. It's a 60s road novel. For me, you know, what I was thinking is that he's applying to kind of the threads from a scene and how those are carried on in the next scene. You know, that's certainly an interesting way of looking at it and of giving someone the tools to set up subsequent scenes. But I guess the thing for me that seemed a little bit unusual was that it makes the scene construction sound chronological or cause and effect.
He's very big on cause and effect.
Which makes sense, except that a lot of times the scenes within a novel can be extended or, you know, delayed to the readers. For example, you might go on to the next scene, and even though the character has experienced what happened before, they might not have processed it yet. Or you might use an entirely different scene with a different set of characters as a way of creating some, say, dramatic pause to allow the character to process things.
Can you give an example from your own work of how you had a character processing a scene?
Yeah. So in my novel, Lucky Ride, the character sets off on a hitchhiking trip across the country to escape his unraveling marriage. So as he's going through his various adventures on the road and through that arc, he's also processing things that happened in his past. You know, in addition to the, you know, some of the things that happens, you know, for example, he almost gets arrested in Texas. He almost gets converted to Christianity a couple of times. So as these things are going on, he's reflecting on his marriage and his experience. And he's also having flashbacks to scenes that happened during his marriage. So that as he goes along, he's processing not only things that happened in the present, in other words, the road trip itself, but things that happened prior to his decision to leave, to set off.
If Jack Bickham was still alive and he went through your book, he probably would identify many sequels. They don't actually hold the scenes together, but it does hold the whole story together, would you say?
Yes, it does. I could have told the story more chronological. You know, maybe it starts at the beginning of his marriage and goes along, and maybe he sets off on the hitchhiking trip halfway through the novel. The way I chose to do it was to, since there's a lot of interesting parallels between a road trip and a personal discovery, the arc of a marriage even, gives it a lot of ways that you can create some interesting parallels and contradictions.
Thanks, Zoe and Terry. If you want to find out more, check out their bios and links in our show notes. And now, on to pacing.
How do you turn a ponderous story into a page turner? How do you take a Michael Bay-paced novel and make it about more than just one disaster after the next? In this episode, we explain Jack Bickham's techniques to speed up or slow down your story's pacing using a structure of scene and sequel.
Today, we're going to focus on Chapter 8, Jack Bickham's scene-sequel tricks to control pace.
I gotta say, this guy could really use with a better titles.
Yeah, you really hate his titles.
They just make me not want to read the chapter.
I guess I don't really think much about it. I'm just like, okay, scene and sequels, controlling pace. What's wrong with it? Scene, sequel, tricks to control pace. It's that's exactly
so I would
what
first,
it's supposed to do.
I would say controlling the pace of your story using scene and sequels.
You know, yeah, okay. You know, I'm indifferent, dear listener. This is just like a Kim thing.
This is a science journalist thing where we were basically taught to see jargon that common people go, ooh, I don't want to think about that, and get rid of it. And scene sequel is just jargon words. Even if you agree with Bickham that there's such a thing as a scene and such a thing as a sequel that works this way.
And this is the hill on which she will die.
Anyway, one thing I liked about this chapter was it started off with him pointing out that he didn't always get this. Once upon a time, there was a young unpublished writer who shall be nameless, except that his initials were JMB. I always like someone that can poke fun at themselves.
Yeah.
So he describes the beginning how he was determined to write an exciting book. So it goes on to say, who decided after having written several unsold novels, he would write the wildest, fastest moving slam bam adventure he could think of. He made a list of exciting, stirring events and wrote the novel from the list. So in other words, he's always been a list man. To his great astonishment and greater chagrin, the novel turned out to be slow moving, pseudo thoughtful, and generally dull and insipid.
Boo!
And he said, many years later, what he realized is he had included too much of sequel and not enough of scene. And the idea here is that scenes are exciting, conflicted, densely packed with action and dialogue, and therefore fast reading. Sequels, on the other hand, are thoughtful, can be extended, have summary in them, and are therefore slow reading.
The key takeaway here is that scenes speed up your book and sequels slow it down.
Right, and that's not surprising. Often writers are told to put things into scenes, not to put summaries in, to make things more exciting.
Right, but you can't just have scene. As we've learned from the last episode, you need to string them together with some glue, which are the sequels.
Right. So he starts off by talking about the problem most writers run into, which is how to speed along the story.
Have you ever, when you've been writing, ever think, I need to speed things up or I need to slow things down? Has that thought even occurred to you?
Oh, yeah. There are times when I'm in the middle of my writing, and I'm looking and saying, this is going so slow. I don't even have the energy to write it. How is someone else going to have the energy to read it?
I see. Okay.
And then usually what I do is I cut out a whole bunch of the verbiage and get back to a scene.
Right. Because I don't really think of these things in these terms. And it makes me think, like, if I had submitted my book and, you know, a publisher took it and then the editor get back to me saying, you need to speed up this chapter. I would be like, what? How do I do that? I don't know. For me, I feel like this is a good revision technique, but maybe not.
No, I think it's a great revision technique. What I like about this chapter is that he comes up with a system for how to speed up or slow down your book, regardless of the content.
Right. So this could work for memoir. This could work for historical novel. This could work for anything.
Usually when you think about how to edit your novel, you're thinking about the content itself. Mm-hmm. And this is just simply, no, it's the structure that your novel is sitting in.
He tackles scene first, and then he goes into sequels. And the first part is how to speed up your story. And he's got 8 bullet points.
The first suggestion is just to remove a sequel. Look through your book, find any scene that doesn't need any kind of transition to the next one, because it just happens. So like your hero falls off the cliff at the end of one scene. The second one can pick up with them falling right then and there. You don't need to have anything in between.
Number 2, transition, i.e. prepositional phrases like 3 hours later or in New York at the plaza. Like you just throw the reader into the next space in a few words and then there you go, jump into scene.
Right. This is like if there's a little bit of pause or a little bit of a location change between those two scenes, like you're not actively falling off the cliff and falling down, but you actually want to say, you know, where they are at the next stage. You don't use a whole sequel. You just give a transition and move on. I was also thinking that it could be like, after she had thought about the mistakes she made, she went to talk to her dad. You don't have to go through the mistakes or the emotions or anything like that.
Right. You can just condense the sequel down into a few words. It reminds me of like when somebody cancels on you last minute and then you get that feeling of relief, like, oh, I have this whole day to do whatever I want. That's what I feel like when I hit some of these sometimes in a book that's a big scene or something. And then they come up with a plan and I'm like, oh, how much am I going to have to read before I get to the next big thing? But no, the author goes, now she's standing at the door, you know, and you're like, yes, action right away.
The next suggestion he has is pretty obvious, which is you cut out some of your words. You look at your sequel and say, does he really need to have to review all of these story events at this time?
Do they really have to like share all those emotions?
Yeah, you just like, let's just cut it back.
It's like your girlfriend, you know. Sure, tell me about your feelings. Oh, sorry, you can cut that out.
And that's the standard thing that most people do when the scene's getting too slow is they just cut back on the wordage.
You could extend a scene right? Because the scene speeds things up, so make that longer. You know, this one is funny. This reminds me of those extended scenes in films, you know, like the extended edition of Lord of the Rings. Like, I haven't seen the theatrical release of that, like, I don't know, since the theatrical release. Mm-hmm. I only ever watched the extended, and those extra scenes are so good. So if your scenes are really, really good, you can keep the pace going by just extending them if it's like a big thing.
So you wrote a small scene, but you can make it bigger.
Yeah.
Next couple ones are, can you find a ways to raise the stakes? And number six, can you increase the scene-ending disaster? So, yeah, those are pretty obvious ones. If you want to make it more exciting, you just pump up the excitement, either by raising what's at stake or you make the disaster bigger.
Yeah.
I found number seven to be actually kind of interesting, which is to look at the timing behind your disasters you have chosen.
Yeah, that one was interesting. He says, set up a disaster so the hero has a week or 10 days to react, when it might be possible to change the disaster only marginally and make it one which requires a sequel and new action right away.
Yeah. A lot of the most exciting movies, if you look at the actual time frame that they happen over a very short amount of time.
Some of them have a ticking time clock, right?
Right. So like if he has to rescue the girl in 24 hours, it's going to be a lot more exciting than if he has 3 weeks.
Right. Or his heart's going to explode if he doesn't keep moving. Well, I forget what movie that was. It was pretty awful, but you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Finally, the last one is changing the protagonist-antagonist's assumptions or plans to tighten the scene.
Right. Like, I mean, I say the word right. I don't really get this one. So wait, I mean, if you figured it out, Kim, you...
This is the point where I have a scene where character A has to convince character B to do something. So you get this long back and forth about how to get this person to do this thing. But if you basically move that first person so they're already amenable to it. Like, for example, let's say our hero wants the heroine to marry him. And if she's not on board, he has to give a whole bunch of reasons to get her into it. If basically she's been kind of angling for it anyway, you're going to go a lot faster.
Right. So you could cut out essentially the middle man. You know how we were earlier doing like the different twists and turns within a scene? Mm-hmm. Maybe remove some of those? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and that will make the scene go faster, especially if there's a whole bunch of stuff you have to work through first to get to that action point. But you're not changing the setting or anything. You're just basically bringing the characters in already prepared to do this next thing.
So I would say that's risky, right? Because I can tell when they agree to things too fast. Like in my head, I'm just like, oh, come on now. They wouldn't just agree to that.
That's because you haven't set up that the person would always agree to it. So like in the, you know, marriage thing, like let's say that in an earlier scene, I have her just walking by and noticing a wedding dress. Then we know that she's already primed for it.
Okay.
You can't just jump your character into doing something, but you can say, I'm going to make it so that they're ready for this thing by placing this other information earlier.
Okay.
So then we move on to
how to slow it down,
which he's honest by saying is not really a problem that most writers run into.
Yeah, I do tend to pontificate a bit. Blah, blah, blah. I'm a poet, damn it. It is what I do. Okay.
Or just because when you write the thing out, often you overwrite.
Definitely an overwriter.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. What are the two terms? Not pantser and plotter. What do you call them? Process writer or?
Discovery writer and outliner.
Okay, so there's the discovery writer and then there's the outliner. But nobody talks about the overwriter. That's what I am.
The great thing about making your book more fast-paced, cutting stuff out, is easy to cut. Cutting is so much faster than what this is to slow stuff down. You actually have to generate more content.
Oh, and cutting is so extremely satisfying. I love cutting.
Yes, it just gets tighter and tighter. He talks about why you'd want to slow things down, where events gallop in on the tail of other events. Story people don't even seem to find the time to think. Things happen so fast and furious that it almost gets ludicrous at times. So he's talking about being too exciting, but what I find in a book like this isn't that I get excited, I get exhausted. I get reader fatigue, where I just don't have the energy to keep going. And so the idea of slowing things down isn't because you're decreasing the overall excitement level of the book. You're just making it so you're giving the readers a bit of a rest so they can recoup and get ready for the next exciting thing to happen. A kind of scientific way of thinking about this is that you can overstimulate. Well, that's the parenting thing. You can overstimulate a child. But you run an experiment where everything is ramped up and there's no way to ramp up the system anymore.
You know, this is interesting. I don't know if I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but one time I was in a workshop and, you know, I wrote a scene of probably some messed up thing my dad did. And then I put some humor in because that's what I do. But I guess I lingered on that intense moment for a while. Maybe it was for like a page or two. And then I cut to some humor. The workshop leader was actually really happy with that. She said, I really liked the humor in there because it allowed us a chance to come down and take a break. So it might be helpful to know that sometimes your scenes are also in a high emotional state for the reader, right? And they, like you said, need a break. And so it's good to sometimes bring them back down, maybe with a sequel.
You use your sequels to reset your audience so that they're ready for this bit of excitement, or you're ready to ramp them up again, or
right,
engage them emotionally.
In like in the case of a memoir, like when there's too much material, which is the one I have, you know, where it's scene, 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 scene. And there's like, oh, they did this and this and this, and they all seem relevant, right? When they're not all relevant, I need to cut some of those scenes. When you've got a lot going on, it probably exhausts a normal person who hasn't had all that crazy stuff in their life.
This is something that might not be noticed when you're reading for a critique group or someone's just reading a chapter at a time and they've got a lot of time in between. This is something I think you can only see when you get that final manuscript there and you have someone read it from start to end.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the way he says to slow things down. And a lot of these are almost opposite of how you speed stuff up. But it starts off by look for scenes that you might possibly cut entirely, telling them in sequel, which means, you know, as opposed to just writing out a scene, just summarize it.
Yeah, you don't need to always put things in scene. This is an issue I have where it's you're trying to follow the rule of the show, no tell. And so you skip sequels thinking everything needs to be shown when that's not always the case.
And he says when you do this, what you're looking for is the weak scenes. Even though you're thinking that, you know, I need to slow it down. I need to, like, you know, slow down the action. You don't want to knock out your big scenes because those are the heart of your story. You want to take something that's more minor, a side character, or Fred goes to the bank to get a loan, something like that, and just summarize it.
Yeah. So the next one is to create a short scene. Make it so that the time period in which things are happening in the scene is shortened so that the scene doesn't play out too long.
Right, because there's less space, you don't quite get as much into the conflict. You're spending less time. And he says story time. You're not there for hours and hours. You just shrink it to like an hour.
Yeah, or, you know, maybe a few lines of dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Again, you're making it shorter to slow down the reading, which is kind of interesting. Similarly, you can start your scene in the middle of things so you don't have to go through all the other conflicts.
Yeah, you could like summarize it up to a point and then get to the juicy bit.
You're just cutting out that energy that people have to devote to conflict. You're decreasing the amount of conflict the reader is going through to give them a break so they can really focus on the important conflict at the end of the scene.
Well said. I like this one. You could make your character think more. Just like, think more.
Well, the idea here is that you've got this magic power, which is in the middle of a scene, a character can stop and just consider what's going on. It's this freeze moment in time where even if a bunch of things are happening, there's no time happening in the story, but there's time happening on the page because the protagonist is thinking something.
Time acts differently in a story. Like there'll be paragraphs that last really a second in the character's life. I guess we've been trained to be okay with that. We'll read paragraphs of thought and then they just say the next thing. Although that would slow your story down way too much.
I have to jump to the example he has at the back of the chapter because it just was so much fun. This is up there with Fanny the stripper scene for just some very good wordage.
No, it doesn't match Fanny the stripper.
But he's talking about the student they had that had written a book and was basically 30,000 words short of what he needed. This is a problem that will never affect me ever, ever, ever. But the student was trying to increase the amount of words. So he had this big scene where a missile is coming out of the silo. And he decided to slow it down, which makes sense. Like, you know, this big moment is happening. You give your character a moment to, like, be in shock at how serious this is going to be. Okay? But he writes, I lectured him about building the scene bigger with more moment-by-moment action. Now, the missile in the silo had the words United States of America painted on its side, vertically, reading from top to bottom. So when my understuffed and too eager to please me student came back with his rewrite of that single shot paragraph, the incident now required about 10 pages. The doors swung open. They took about 2 agonizing pages of description of motor whirling, concrete groaning, metal screeching, etc. to get open. Then the missile was fired. It's axiomatic that time can stand still for the character at such moments of crisis, but what my student did was extraordinary in extremity. The nose of the missile appeared above the surface. 1 page of description for the shape and particular color of red on that tip was painted. The first linear foot of the missile appeared as it began to rise. We saw the letter U. 2 paragraphs, a character internalization about how terrible this was. Next came the letter N. Another few paragraphs about how awful and what the next letter would be and how he'd arrived too late, etc. By the time we got to the next page, out came another foot or so of the rising missile and we saw the letter I.
Oh, God.
More internalization. It took a full 10 pages to get the missile out of the silo as we counted out letter by letter, UNITEDSTATES, and so forth. I love this alphabet approach that they're going to spell out the letters. So that is the danger, is slowing it down by stopping in the middle of the action to think.
This is another problem with show don't tell. Is people think to show and they go overboard, but they've slowed it down and then threw in all these sequels and all this stuff when he just needed to heighten the tension a little bit.
And that's why this can be harder than making things faster, because you're actually having to generate new content. And that's hard.
It is hard. It is hard, especially since that sounds like it is climax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So number 5 is look for ways to build in more breathing time for your viewpoint characters between scenes. Bickham actually says you don't have to make the disaster quite as much of a disaster. There's a scene where a child falls through the ice, but instead of having the child fall through the ice, you just show the ice cracking and the parental figure grabbing the child. So it's still exciting because, you know, we're worried about someone falling through the ice, but we don't have to deal with all the repercussions of a rescue scene.
Well, it says the main way to do this, by changing some of your scene goals or disasters so that the character will have more time for sequel before he is forced by story circumstances to act again.
Okay, I see. So it's not decreasing the tension by decreasing the disaster so much as it's by giving the character more space to sequel in between.
Giving more time in between events so that the character does have more time to think through things and have a longer sequel. All right, number 6. Study your existing sequels and consider expanding one or more or parts of them. So just like the extended scene, you could extend the sequel a little bit. And I guess that's an obvious one because the longer the sequel, the more it'll slow things down.
And using what he said to have in a sequel, you can say, well, is there enough emotion? Is there enough thought? Is there enough, you know, decision making? You just kind of go in and add a paragraph here, add a paragraph there.
Yeah.
Bickham says that you can even move back as you expand your sequel to actually require you to jump back. Maybe something is happening in the thought process that's so important that you have to go back to your emotions again.
Right.
So then number 7, changing the nature of some of your existing scenes so they don't really function well as scenes any longer.
What? Wait, what? Slowing the pace by changing the nature of some of your existing scenes so they don't really function well as scenes any longer. Or making the scene-ending disaster subtle. Oh, so that the character simply walks away in a state of befuddlement. I have done this in real life multiple times. I had a student, and he had a bunch of group of friends with him, and they were trying to mess with me, like as a teacher, I guess. They thought it was funny. It was weird conversation. And they said something really weird to me, and I just walked away. I'm like, I'm going to go eat my lunch.
And then afterwards, like, damn it! Those jerks!
Well, no, I knew. I was already thinking that. And then I was like, this is really awkward. I think I'm just going to leave now.
What I got out of this is all those things he was telling us not to do in our scenes earlier. He said, well, you know, if you kind of let yourself do that, if you make it so that the scene goal isn't quite obvious, or you don't quite build the conflict as much, or you don't obviously show the disaster, then it will slow things down and you might decide you just need that. Although you shouldn't write your scenes that way to start with.
There's a lot of this going on in this book, man. Like, you've got, do this. You must do all these things in the next chapter. Okay, you don't have to do all those things. You should do all those things if you're not practiced. And then the next chapter, you could totally not do any of those things if you just want to do this one weird trick. It's kind of wishy-washy. And also, he doesn't really give examples throughout this whole thing. There are no examples. I'm just like, rule, rule, rule. Who's going to remember any of this when they go to write their book?
2 points there. First, he has to say there are exceptions because nobody writes exactly like he says in this book. If you wrote your novel exactly like he said with your scene and structure and all those deals, no one would want to read it. As a writer, you need to be able to play with this stuff and to modify things to make your story work.
Right.
Okay. You have to have exceptions. But the second one about not having any examples, I think this is a really good chapter to have on the shelf when it comes time to revise your novel, to basically pull out this set of rules. And as you're reading through, if you need to speed it up, take a look at those options there. If you need to slow it down, look at these other options. But it's not a fun chapter to read, despite the bit about the rocket at the end.
The bit about the rocket, well, yeah, that was pretty funny.
We have a list of reasons why people tend to write too slow. And I found most of these to be stuff he's already covered. But the two that I liked, number 3 and number 4 on that list, which is, first of all, people don't realize how easy it is to get to 60,000 words or more. And so they end up just stuffing the book with sequel.
I can see that.
And the other one is that writing scene conflict is hard. As a writer, it's exhausting too.
And we had an episode on something called Purple Prose, if you have not read it. And so number 2 on this list, I think, harkens back to that. Beginners focus on their interior life of the character's thoughts or feelings, failing to understand the reader's yearning for outside action of some kind, played on stage in the story now. So number 5. Too many beginners want to be poetic or philosophical, so they write overblown sequels to wax rhapsodic about character emotion or bombast about their profound ideas. And I wrote a little note that says, yikes. The problem is when you're young, you think your thoughts are profound because you haven't heard anyone say them yet, but that's because you haven't had the experience yet to hear people or read a lot of stuff that they've already covered these ideas.
But also, writing allows you to explore ideas, and you're going to put those ideas on the page. The problem is when you're attempting to mimic a style and be poetic or philosophical, that's really painful.
Yeah. And again, like I said, my beginning creative writing students will try to sound like Shakespeare because he was famous. And they think, oh, well, I'll try my hand at it, too. And unless that's the assignment to write a Shakespearean sonnet, you know, I tell them, I say, if I want to read Shakespeare, I'll read Shakespeare. I won't read your version of Shakespeare.
The other issue I had with this chapter is that there's no exercises for us at the end.
Yeah.
And this is a global strategy for a book. I don't have a whole novel to go through. And even if I did have a whole novel to go through and look at this stuff, it'd be way too much for an exercise.
Right. It's hard to judge pacing by just a chapter. Mm-hmm.
But what I did do is I found a piece that I'd been introduced to in a writing workshop many years ago. So this is from, I believe it's a short story called Triptych by Danzy Senna. And he wrote three versions of a story, varying certain details, but the plot is roughly similar. Example was given to us as how to go from exterior to interior. It's not an action sequence. It's not a mystery. It's not a thriller. It's actually much more artful, which I kind of like. And I'm going to read the three passages. In a way, it is scene and sequel here that he does, or that she does. And you can kind of see how a sequel can expand and change the feel of the piece. 1. Cherries in winter. Aunt Mabel made all the food. She and Uncle Gus drove from Syracuse this morning with a whole trunkload of steaming Tupperware. "Have you chosen a major?" Gus asked her from across the table. "Fine arts." "Better than crude arts," he snorted with laughter. Andrea just nods and takes another sip of wine. Peaches in winter. Aunt Grace made all the food. She and Uncle Brian drove all the way up to the city this morning with a whole trunkload of steaming Tupperware. "Have you chosen a major?" Brian asked her from across the table. "English literature." "Uh-oh, you know what that means, James," he said. "She'll be moving back in after graduation." He snorts with laughter. "All these liberal art kids do nowadays." The thought of moving back here after college had filled her mouth with the taste of metal. She takes a sip of sweet tea, trying to wash it away. And finally, plums in winter. Aunt Rose made all the food. She and Uncle Izzy drove down from Boston this morning with a whole trunkload of steaming Tupperware. "Have you chosen a major?" Izzy asked her from across the table. "Women's studies," she said. "Uh-oh, Dave," Izzy says, smirking at her father. "Sounds like trouble. Should have sent her down south for some college." She wants to say to him what she has learned. None of it in class. Some women are born to play dumb. Some women are too smart for their own good. Some women are born to give, and some women only know how to take. Some women learn who they want to be from their mothers, some who they don't want to be. Some mothers suffer so their daughters won't. Some mothers love so their daughters won't. She wants to tell him that she has lost the one thing tying her to this scene, that nothing binds her to this anymore, that she is light and she is free and she is mourning not just her mother, but her prison too. Instead, she forces a smile up at him and sips her water.
That was awesome.
I know. That's just a section of the story. But what I was thinking is we could use this as an inspiration. We could take one of our own scenes and we could write it in these three different ways. Or maybe just write it twice. But using sequel or some of the other techniques he explained to speed up or slow down the scene. So maybe we should start with in the middle and then we should figure out a way to speed it up. And then we should figure out a way to slow it down.
That's good. And then you get to practice. So we're going to go and we're going to do the activity. And then we're going to come back and we're going to workshop this. And one of our responses and our workshops will be on this episode, which will be in a few seconds. But if you want the other person's workshop, the extended version, you go to our Patreon page where you could become a member and you can listen to our bonus podcast.
Yep. And so that's our basic subscriber level. But then we're also offering more stuff on our Patreon site if you really want to improve your craft. If you go to our Patreon site and sign up at our Pinto level, we will include a very detailed description of this exercise with examples and things to help you along and things that we learn while doing it that we might realize we did wrong the first time, as well as Renee's snark notes for the chapter we just read.
The show notes are really just notes on the episode that you just listened to. But if you want a study guide for this chapter, you get the snark notes.
And this is actually a pretty good study guide because it really is a checklist of how to go through your novel and check for pacing.
Yeah, I put a lot of work in. I find examples. I'm big into examples. I don't like it when people are really general or vague and then they don't follow up with something like specific. So I throw that in there.
And then finally, we're offering a new tier, our Azuki the Boss level. And that's if, in addition to just reading about these exercises, you're really stoked to write these exercises and you want our feedback. And so you can check out our Patreon site and see that. But I think now we will get to our writing.
Yeah. Hi, and welcome to our exercise portion of the podcast. Today, we're going to read Kim's take on taking a sequel and using it to slow down the pace or speed up the pace, according to the chapter we just read.
And then in our bonus podcast, Renee has a scene from her memoir that she works on slowing down, and we could discuss how she went about doing it and how it worked or didn't work. And now on to my sequel. This is from the beginning of the book, where we have the character Sufi looking at a tower and seeing that there's this beam of light signaling that the heroes were coming from the other world to have a quest. And she decides she's going to be the one to open the portal. So the next scene after that is her going to the magistrate and saying, I should be the one to open the portal. And the magistrate saying, nope, we're not going to open the portal until one of the adult magicians or priests get back to open it. And so this sequel is meant to happen right after Sufi leaves the magistrate.
Do you know which guidelines you used for this first version?
So I first have just the sequel as is. I was going to start with that, and I could talk about what stuff I didn't modified.
Okay, cool.
And I wrote the sequel to fit a Jack Bickham sequel. So we've got emotion, we've got thought, which includes like a rehashing, an analysis, planning, and then we've got a decision and action. Do you understand me? Asked Lenora. Sufi managed to nod and walked out of the magistrate's office. She kept her face a mask, but inside she was roiling with emotions, outrage fueling frustration and self-righteousness, punctuated by snide insults at Lenora, her family, the short-sighted townsfolk of Inanak, her old teachers at the magic school, anyone to keep her from letting the misery that was stewing beneath it all from rising up and overwhelming her. Lenora was just going to leave the hero stuck between worlds until the priest or her uncle returned. That could be days, maybe weeks. In the meantime, those wrongs the heroes were meant to be righting would just keep happening. Unless, a horrible thought struck her, the divine wisdom decided to send the otherworlders to a different hero's shrine. And then Sufi would be stuck gathering herbs for her uncle, making potions for rheumatic farmers, and teaching their children rudimentary magic until she was old and as gray as the town itself. This morning in the tower, she'd been so certain that this was her destiny, and now that shiny hope was fading. Sufi's mask began to crumble and her eyes got watery. No, she hadn't been wrong. She couldn't be wrong. The heroes were meant to come to Inanak, and she was meant to let them out. But she needed some help. She went to find Havlin. So that's a pretty straightforward sequel. Hits all the main points. And actually, it's not terribly slow. I think if I were writing this, that would be kind of the one I'd use because it fits the right amount of pacing.
Yeah, actually, as a sequel, this does do everything Bickham says to do. You've got the internalization. You've got the emotion. She's frustrated. You've got her planning. And then she makes her choice.
So then if I was looking at this and deciding this first chapter is going on way too long, I just need to get Sufi to get those darn heroes out of the portal. I don't want to muck around with all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I looked at the sequel and I thought I could basically cut out a whole bunch of it. That was the big thing, you know, cut out all those various steps that a sequel has. And then also I decided to use this method of realigning the protagonists or the other characters' mental states, so that they were already further along, so it didn't require as much, not conflict, but evolution of idea. Mm-hmm. And so specifically, I decided I would put Sufi in the point where she didn't need to have that crisis and that resolution, where she was already kind of leaving Lenora's office with a plan. Do you understand me? Asked Lenora. Sufi managed to nod and walked out of the magistrate's office. She kept her face a mask of accepting compliance as she walked down the hall, out into the courtyard, through the gatehouse and over the bridge to where her friend Havlent, the ranger, waited. Did she say yes? He asked. Sufi shook her head. We're doing plan B. So much shorter.
Very short. It is down to bare bones. There's not much else you could cut. Besides the ranger, just because you didn't even mention who Havlent was in the previous one. So I guess you could cut out three more words or two words. But man, so this is interesting. I think this actually changes the character a little bit.
Right. I had to change Sufi's character so that she wasn't going to have all that emotional, like I skipped out that entire emotional arc that she had right there, made her a person that would talk to Lenora and say, okay, she won't let me do it. I'll do it another way.
Yeah, exactly. Like in this first one, we get to know her more. We get to know what the stakes are she's overwhelmed, but she's also just kind of desperate in the sequel. But in the next version, she more is like a soldier, right? Or she's more like very stubborn. I mean, she's less of a round character. I kind of like react to this character in a way I like, because I like the strong female protagonists in like sci-fi and fantasy. And a lot of them are like this, right? Where they're like, fuck it, I don't care, I'll do what I want.
So what I would do in this case is I could move some of the arguments that she had about having to let the heroes out now and the divine wisdom changing his mind or some other thing. I can move all that to the conflict scene beforehand with her discussion with Lenora.
Yeah, but I don't want to say I liked it better, because you're not supposed to say that in a workshop, but I thought the previous version was more effective in a characterization. I liked the characterization because I got to know her a little bit better, and she's not just some cookie cutter badass.
Right, but they have to realize this is in the context of the scenes that go on either side and the rest of the chapter. This would require me shuffling out some of that stuff to the scenes on either side, but what the result is, it would be a much faster paced chapter overall.
Yeah.
Because we have a conflict with Lenora, and now we're going to go have this conflict, not with Havlin, but Havlin and she are going to go do the next scene. And then that's going to be another setup. So it just means the whole thing moves faster.
Yeah.
And I think whenever you cut back on a sequel in order to put it to the next scene, you're going to lose characterization.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I could see both of these versions in a book, like in different books. With some books, things are a little bit slower and there's a lot more characterization. In other books, just let's go, let's do it. And it's interesting because that's going to change the character too. It didn't even occur to me that that's the case, but it's true. Like, this is a semi-different character. And if the character is someone who's very stubborn and just let's go get him, that's going to speed the book up.
Someone who sits around thinking about everything all the time is going to be a much slower book.
Right. So your character is going to kind of choose the pacing for you a little bit.
Yeah, but I think we're looking too closely at this particular sequel.
Okay.
When you've got your full book, you've got plenty of time to develop this character in other spaces, or you can develop this character during a scene.
Mm-hmm.
The great thing about Bickham's approach to changing sequels and scenes to increase pacing is you're not changing the content of your story. Maybe you're moving around a little bit, but you can have all that doubt that Sufi had. I could include that whole bit of doubt in the previous scene with Lenora, and the Lenora saying, you know, the heroes will be just fine back there. And Sufi thinking, but what if they aren't? What if the divine wisdom sends them somewhere else and I'm not even here? No, she says to Lenora, I think I should be doing this. And Lenora says, no, no.
Right.
But we bumped that internalization into the scene as opposed to the sequel.
You have a third version here too.
Yeah, then I slowed it down. I wanted to figure out a way to emotionally slow it down. Because in my original sequel, we're still moving very much forward. Like, things are still happening, we're building, and we jump out to the next scene. Here, I wanted to actually just kind of go more for introspection, and it would probably require more ramping up to get the story back going in the next scene. So here, I purposely wanted the whole thing just to slow down. "Do you understand me?" asked Lenora. Sufi managed to nod and walked out of the magistrate's office. She kept her face a mask. Behind it, Lenora's voice continued to echo. "When you're young, everything feels like it must be now, now, now. When you're older, you'll see the value of a little patience." When you're older, you're going to look back at the time in Inanak and appreciate being free from distractions, grateful for a chance to focus on your studies. The parting words from her advisor, Professor Shabala. A kinder version of what her grandfather sent off. "Your uncle will send me a message when he feels you are ready to retake your exams." "You're going to be a fine wizard. You just need to buckle down," her mother. "I was a bit of a late bloomer myself," her father. "Your spells would work if you spent more time practicing, less time daydreaming," her sister. "Too bad you can't be a warlock like me," her brother. "Why do you even want to be a wizard? You should come out to the Pewter Mugs. There's a great bard performing tonight," her friend. "Sufi, your grandfather and we have been talking." A sharp wind hit her face, drying the tears that had flowed without her realizing. She'd come back to the tower. In daylight, the divine wisdom's beacon was hardly a shimmer, but she could still feel it sending shivers through her skin. I wish I could be like you. She'd spoken those words to her grandmother, usually after she'd been regaled with the story of the sorceress's adventures with the otherworlder heroes of her youth. I wish I could be like you. It's not wishing, she'd replied. It's about doing. Sufi closed her eyes, took a deep breath, opening herself to the magical disturbance of the semi-open portal. It flowed into her, making her knees tremble, her teeth chattered. It's about doing. Sufi opened her eyes. The mask was gone. Her face was puffy and tight and anxious. The face of someone who was done with wishing.
Hmm. It's interesting because it's like internal scenes going on in her brain.
Right, but by definition, it can't have an internal scene.
Right, I know, I know. But it's making thoughts into scenes in the sense that you're sharing dialogue from a previous scenario, but it's a list of them.
I meant to take out all those elements of a Bickham sequence. I took out a lot of saying what her emotions were. I just had people's words. I took out her thinking about what everything meant. I just had her listening to those words and those thoughts running through her head.
Mm-hmm.
And I took away her actually formulating a plan or any sort of action other than that she was done wishing.
Right. I like that ending too. This, again, her character is a little different. Here, her goal is different. Like before, we're not quite sure what she's going to be up to, but she has a clear plan and it involves somebody else. This one, she's acting out of more desperation.
Yes, I'd have to have everything set up for the plan with Havlin afterwards. It would slow things down because I'd have to add more information for the reader to restart the adventure.
Right. There's going to be a whole other scene with Havlin. Like, we're going to have a whole scene. He's going to have to argue with her. It's going to have to end in a disaster. There might even be another sequel in there, depending. Maybe it breaches her more to this point, too, where now she's just so desperate, she's going to go rogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting in terms of pacing, because the thoughts were pieces of dialogue. I feel like the first version is slower because she's talking about things in her head and she's ruminating over her worries. These worries, though, in this last version are more things that would end up in scene. These are the scenes of her life replaying in her head. The narrative distance between these thoughts and those thoughts of the first version. The first version, she's more distant from them. She's thinking of things in generalities, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this one, anytime you have specific dialogue, I would consider dialogue showing, not telling. And so in a sense, these are almost like mini scenes. And they're very powerful because they are dialogue. And I feel like she's getting smacked in the face every time, which I'm sure that was what you had in mind when you did it. It worked out really well.
I don't think the goal of slowing down your pacing is meant to kind of lull the reader.
Mm-hmm.
I think it actually can engage the reader quite a bit. The triptych piece that we read, and I don't have it visible, but the part that it slowed down was a long dialogue in the protagonist's head about exactly what she'd learned in her liberal arts thing. And it was actually some pretty powerful stuff. In fact, it ended on the basic idea that now that her mother was dead, she was never seeing these people again, which has a punch.
Mm-hmm.
But it also slowed things down because we were outside the dialogue at the table.
Any of these pieces, I have seen this played out in different books. So I'm not trying to say any of this is boring. All three of these are equally valid. Which one are you most likely to choose for your book and why?
You know, that's the thing. I think it depends on the overall chapter when it gets done.
I see.
Probably I'll go with the first one because I'm just trying to transition with enough information about Sufi, but maybe I will move that information over to the scenes and get the really short sequel. I doubt that I will go with the last one because I might save that emotional punch for later on. But I think it's context. Like you said, they're all valid. It's just what works for your story that you have in front of you.
Right. Yeah, you've got some lines in there. Just, man, people are cruel to her. It's effed up, man. It's a brutal society she lives in. If if her family's treating her this way and everyone else is treating her this way, you could just use one line of this dialogue in her head, any of them. These are all so electrically charged that they could stand on their own, but they work in a list, but they could also stand on their own.
I think as a writer, we know all this stuff, and it's just a matter of what stuff we choose to use where.
Exactly. Exactly. You did a better job than I did in pacing. Like, I kind of didn't quite get it, but I can see it now.
I did start this by thinking, well, maybe I'll go back to one of the short stories I was working on. I had a hard time because I had looked at stuff that was already polished, and there wasn't any place where I could really see to expand or contract. Mm-hmm. And so I actually went ahead and wrote this scene afresh, or the sequel afresh. I knew I needed it. The original version of my opening chapter is presented differently.
Mm-hmm.
For the podcast, I had rewritten the opening, which gave me the opportunity to say that I would need this scene with Sufi and Lenora, and then that would require a sequel after the Sufi and Lenora conversation. So I knew I needed a sequel there. So I won't say I cheated, but I did have the advantage of starting with the Bickham sequel, which makes it easier to modify because it already has those things in place that he says to modify.
Right, right. And I didn't necessarily do that.
Looking at it that way, it might mean that a lot of Bickham's advice works if you started with a Bickham approach at the beginning.
That is a good, yeah, that is very important, I think. I would have to change my scenes to fit. You can't just do pieces of Bickham. I mean, I guess you could, but it's not going to work well if you don't.
It's going to be a lot harder. The whole goal of Bickham is that if you simply follow this idea of scene and sequel with these rules, it will be much easier for you to write your story because you have these structures in place.
It will be a lot easier to write a type of story, a Bickham type of story.
By definition, the idea is to write a story using the Bickham principles will be easier than trying to make it up as you go along.
I see. Okay.
And that whole frustration of like, I don't know how to get this thing in, or I don't know how to change the pacing of this part of this story, or I don't know how to fix these problems. You can use the Bickham approach to fix those problems or structure your story so long as you're using the Bickham approach.
Right. Like, if you put the scene disaster in there, that gives the character something to think about and then to plan for and then to act. And then that will kick off your next scene. They all kind of like work together.
Yeah, and that's why I couldn't use it for some of the stuff I'd previously written because it didn't follow the Bickham principles.
No, that's a question. Are you going to go back and make it fit the Bickham principles, or are you going to keep just doing your own thing?
These are some short stories I've written in the past.
Oh, these are short stories.
This book here, I actually think I'm going to follow a lot of the Bickham principles because it is a genre fantasy.
Nice.
It's made to fit that. And then, you know, there'll be variations and changes and things like that. But as far as getting it out on paper...
Yeah, it'll turn it into a page turner.
Yeah, well, that was one of the goals. So
awesome.
So in a way, I think because I used Bickham's structure, it made for a pretty easy exercise. And you had a slightly different approach that we will discuss in our bonus podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Many errors were made, but that's okay. No, it's great. You know, one of the ways that made me a better writer, at least in academia, was becoming a tutor. And when I became a tutor, I saw all of the things that other students had doing. And even though I myself didn't always do those things, I saw where they were going wrong. And then that enhanced my ability as a writer. So I think our listeners will get a lot out of seeing what I did because they themselves are probably doing similar stuff. And then they'll be able to see how they can fix it.
So bonus podcast with Renee's exercise. Or you can also go and listen to Phil Nichols' interview with us on the Bradbury 100 podcast. The bonus podcast is part of our Patreon account. We hope that you look into that. And Renee, what other ways can they support us?
They could go to Apple Podcasts and they can leave us a really cool review, a really nice review. And if you do, we will read it on the air. You can also visit our website and read our show notes. You could subscribe to our newsletter. That could be very helpful.
And you could pass our newsletter on to a friend of yours or tell a friend of yours to come and listen to the podcast.
Yes, please share the podcast with your writer friends. That would be really helpful. And you could totally add me on LinkedIn. Do you need a connection? I will totally add you on LinkedIn. I got your back.
And as we, as you've been listening to the beginning of these episodes, where we've been including interviews with editors and published writers, if you feel like you'd like to be part of one of these things, check out Renee's LinkedIn pages and contact her through there. And we would love to continue doing these interviews. And I would love to reach out to as many different published writers to talk to you and to showcase your work. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smiga-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
And now we have the leaf blower.
And now we have the leaf blower.